4. In Grandfather's former study, which even on the hottest days was the dampest room in their country house, no matter how much they opened the windows that looked straight out on grim dark fir trees, whose foliage was so thick and intricate that it was impossible to say where one tree ended and another began, in this uninhabited room, where a bronze boy with violin stood on the bare desk, there was an unlocked bookcase containing the thick volumes of an extinct illustrated magazine. Lucian would swiftly leaf through them until he reached the page where, between a poem by Korinfsky, crowned with a harp-shaped vignette, and the miscellany section containing information about shifting swamps, American eccentrics, and the length of the human intestine, there was the woodcut of a chessboard. Not a single picture could arrest Lucian's hand as it leafed through the volumes, neither the celebrated Niagara Falls, nor starving Indian children, pot-bellied little skeletons, nor an attempted assassination of the King of Spain. The life of the world passed by with a hasty rustle and suddenly stopped, the treasured diagram, problems, openings, entire games. At the beginning of the summer holidays, he had sorely missed his aunt and the old gentleman with the bunch of flowers, especially that fragrant old man smelling at times of violets and at times of lilies of the valley, depending upon what flowers he had brought to Lucian's aunt. Usually, he would arrive just right, a few minutes after Lucian's aunt had glanced at her watch and left the house.
"Never mind, let's wait a while," the old man would say, removing the damp paper from his bouquet, and Lucian would draw up an armchair for him to the table where the chessmen had already been set out. The appearance of the old gentleman with the flowers had provided him with a way out of a rather awkward situation. After 3 or 4 truancies from school, it became apparent that his aunt had really no aptitude for chess. As the game proceeded, her pieces would conglomerate in an unseemly jumble, out of which there would suddenly dash an exposed, helpless king. But the old gentleman played divinely. The first time his aunt, pulling on her gloves, had said rapidly, "Unfortunately, I must leave, but you stay on and play chess with my nephew. Thank you for the wonderful lilies of the valley." The first time the old man had sat down and sighed,
"It's a long time since I touched. Now, young man, left or right?"
This first time, when, after a few moves, Lucian's ears were burning and there was nowhere to advance, it seemed to Lucian he was playing a completely different game from the one his aunt had taught him. The board was bathed in fragrance. The old man called the officer a bishop and the tower a rook. And whenever he made a move that was fatal for his opponent, he would immediately take it back. And, as if disclosing the mechanism of an expensive instrument, he would show the way his opponent should have played in order to avert disaster. He won the first 15 games without the slightest effort, not pondering his moves for a moment. But during the 16th game, he suddenly began to think, and won with difficulty. While on the last day, the day he drove up with a whole bush of lilac for which no place could be found, and the boy's aunt darted about on tiptoe in her bedroom, and then presumably left by the back door, on this last day, after a long exciting struggle during which the old man revealed a capacity for breathing hard through the nose, Lucian perceived something. Something was set free within him. Something cleared up. And the mental myopia that had been painfully beclouding his chess vision disappeared.
"Well, well, it's a draw," said the old man.
He moved his queen back and forth a few times, the way you move the lever of a broken machine, and repeated,
"A draw, perpetual check."
Lucian also tried the lever to see if it would work, wiggled it, wiggled it, and then sat still, staring stiffly at the board.
"You'll go far," said the old man. You'll go far if you continue on the same lines. Tremendous progress. Never saw anything like it before. Yes, you'll go very, very far.
It was this old man who explained to Lujin the simple method of notation in chess, and Lujin, replaying the games given in the magazine, soon discovered in himself a quality he had once envied when his father used to tell somebody at table that he personally was unable to understand how his father-in-law could read a score for hours and hear in his mind all the movements of the music as he ran his eye over the notes, now smiling, now frowning, and sometimes turning back like a reader checking a detail in a novel, a name, the time of the year.
"It must be a great pleasure," his father had said, "to assimilate music in its natural state."
It was a similar pleasure that Lujin himself now began to experience as he skimmed fluently over the letters and numbers representing moves. At first, he learned to replay the immortal games that remained from former tournaments. He would rapidly glance over the notes of chess and silently move the pieces on his board. Now and then, this or that move, provided in the text with an exclamation or a question mark, depending upon whether it had been beautifully or wretchedly played, would be followed by several series of moves in parentheses, since that remarkable move branched out like a river, and every branch had to be traced to its conclusion before one returned to the main channel. These possible continuations that explained the essence of blunder or foresight, Lujin gradually ceased to reconstruct actually on the board and contented himself with perceiving their melody mentally through the sequence of symbols and signs. Similarly, he was able to read a game already perused once without using the board at all. And this was all the more pleasant in that he did not have to fiddle about with chessmen while constantly listening for someone coming. The door, it is true, was locked, and he would open it unwillingly after the brass handle had been jiggled many times, and Lujin Sr., coming to see what his son was doing in that damp, uninhabited room, would find his son restless and sullen with red ears. On the desk lay the bound volumes of the magazine, and Lujin Sr. would be seized by the suspicion that his son might have been looking for pictures of naked women.
"Why do you lock yourself up?" he would ask, and little Lujin would draw his head into his shoulders and with hideous clarity imagine his father looking under the sofa and finding the chess set. "The air in here's really icy, and what's so interesting about these old magazines? Let's go and see if there are any red mushrooms under the fir trees."
Yes, they were there, those edible red boletes. Green needles adhered to their delicately brick-colored caps, and sometimes a blade of grass would leave on one of them a long, narrow trace. Their undersides might be holy, and occasionally a yellow slug would be sitting there, and Lujin Sr. would use his pocket knife to clean moss and soil from the thick speckled gray root of each mushroom before placing it in the basket. His son followed behind him at a few paces distance, with his hands behind his back like a little old man. And not only did he not look for mushrooms, but even refused to admire those his father, with little quacks of pleasure, unearthed himself. And sometimes, plump and pale in a dreary white dress that did not become her, Mrs. Lujin would appear at the end of the avenue and hurry toward them, passing alternately through sunlight and shadow, and the dry leaves that never ceased to occur in northern woods would rustle beneath the slightly skewed high heels of her white slippers. One July day, she slipped on the veranda steps and sprained her foot, and for a long time afterwards, she lay in bed, either in her darkened bedroom or on the veranda, wearing a pink negligee, her face heavily powdered, and there would always be a small silver bowl with boule de gomme, balls of hard candy, standing on a little table beside her. The foot was soon better, but she continued to recline, as if having made up her mind that this was to be her lot, that this precisely was her destiny in life. Summer was unusually hot. The mosquitoes gave no peace. All day long, the shrieks of peasant girls bathing could be heard from the river, and on one such oppressive and voluptuous day, early in the morning before the gadflies had yet begun to torment the black horse daubed with pungent ointment, Lucian Sr. stepped into the calash and was taken to the station to spend the day in town.
"At least be reasonable. It's essential for me to see Silvestrov," he had said to his wife the night before, pacing about the bedroom in his mouse-colored dressing gown. "Really, how queer you are! Can't you see this is important? I myself would prefer not to go."
But his wife continued to lie with her face thrust into the pillow, and her fat, helpless back shook with sobs. Nonetheless, in the morning, he left, and his son, standing in the garden, saw the top part of the coachman and his father's hat skim along the serrated line of young firs that fenced off the garden from the road. That day, Lucian Jr. was in low spirits. All the games in the old magazine had been studied, all the problems solved, and he was forced to play with himself. But this ended inevitably in an exchange of all the pieces and a dull draw. And it was unbearably hot. The veranda cast a black triangular shadow on the bright sand. The avenue was paved with sunflecks, and these spots, if you slitted your eyes, took on the aspect of regular light and dark squares. An intense, lattice-like shadow lay flat beneath a garden bench. The urns that stood on stone pedestals at the four corners of the terrace threatened one another across their diagonals. Swallows soared. Their flight recalled the motion of scissors swiftly cutting out some design. Not knowing what to do with himself, he wandered down the footpath by the river, and from the opposite bank came ecstatic squeals and glimpses of naked bodies. He stole behind a tree trunk and, with beating heart, peered at these flashes of white. A bird rustled in the branches, and taking fright, he quickly left the river and went back. He had lunch alone with the housekeeper, a taciturn, sallow-faced old woman who always gave off a slight smell of coffee. Afterwards, lolling on the drawing-room couch, he drowsily listened to all manner of slight sounds, to an oriole's cry in the garden, to the buzzing of a bumblebee that had flown in the window, to the tinkle of dishes on a tray being carried down from his mother's bedroom. And these limpid sounds were strangely transformed in his reverie and assumed the shape of bright, intricate patterns on a dark background. And in trying to unravel them, he fell asleep. He was wakened by the steps of the maid dispatched by his mother. It was dim and cheerless in the bedroom. His mother drew him to her, but he braced himself and turned away so stubbornly that she had to let him go.
"Come, tell me something," she said softly.
He shrugged his shoulders and picked at his knee with one finger.
"Don't you want to tell me anything?" she asked, still more softly.
He looked at the bedside table, put a boule de gomme in his mouth, and began to suck. He took a second, a third, another, and another, until his mouth was full of sweet thudding and bumping balls.
"Take some more. Take as many as you wish," she murmured.
And stretching one hand from under the bedclothes, she tried to touch him, to stroke him.
"You haven't got tanned at all this year," she said after a pause. "But perhaps I simply can't see. The light here is so dead. Everything looks blue. Raise the Venetian blinds, please. Oh, no, wait, stay. Later."
Having sucked his boule de gomme to the end, he inquired if he could leave. She asked him what he would do now, and would he not like to drive to the station and meet his father off the 7 o'clock train?
"Let me go," he said. "It smells of medicine in here."
He tried to slide down the stairs the way they did at school, the way he himself never did it there, but the steps were too high. Beneath the staircase, in a cupboard that had still not been thoroughly explored, he looked for magazines. He dug out one and found a checkers section in it, diagrams of stupid, clumsy round blobs on their boards, but there was no chess. As he rummaged on, he kept coming across a bothersome herbarium album with dried edelweiss and purple leaves in it, and with inscriptions in pale violet ink in a childish, thin-spun hand that was so different from his mother's present handwriting. Davos, 1885. Gatchina, 1886. Wrathfully, he began to tear out the leaves and flowers, sneezing from the fine dust as he squatted on his haunches amid the scattered books. Then it got so dark beneath the stairs that the pages of the magazine he was again leafing through began to merge into a gray blur, and sometimes a small picture would trick him because it looked like a chess problem in the diffuse darkness. He thrust the books back anyhow into the drawers and wandered into the drawing room, thinking listlessly that it must be well past 7 o'clock, since the butler was lighting the kerosene lamps. Leaning on a cane and holding on to the banisters, his mother in mauve peignoir came heavily down the stairs, a frightened look on her face.
"I don't understand why your father isn't here yet," she said,
and moving with difficulty, she went out onto the veranda and began to peer down the road between the fir trunks that the setting sun banded with bright copper. He came only around 10, said he had missed the train, had been extremely busy, had dined with his publisher. "No, no soup, thank you." He laughed and spoke very loudly and ate noisily, and Lucian was struck by the feeling that his father was looking at him all the time, as if staggered by his presence. Dinner graded into late evening tea. Mother, her elbow propped on the table, silently slitted her eyes at her plate of raspberries, and the gayer her husband's stories became, the narrower her eyes grew. Then she got up and quietly left. And it seemed to Lucian that all this had happened once before. He remained alone on the veranda with his father, and was afraid to raise his head, feeling that strange, searching stare on him the whole time.
"How have you been passing the time?" asked his father suddenly. "What have you been doing?"
"Nothing," replied Lucian.
"And what are you planning to do now?"
asked Lucian Sr. in the same tone of forced jollity, imitating his son's manner of using the formal plural for you.
"Do you want to go to bed, or do you want to sit here with me?"
Lucian killed a mosquito, and very cautiously stole a glance upwards and sideways at his father. There was a crumb on his father's beard, and an unpleasantly mocking expression gleamed in his eyes.
"Do you know what?"
his father said, and the crumb jumped off.
"Do you know what? Let's play some game. For instance, how about me teaching you chess?"
He saw his son slowly blush, and taking pity on him, immediately added,
"Or Kabbalah. There's a pack of cards over there in the table drawer." "But no chess set. We have no chess set," said Lucian huskily, and again stole a cautious look at his father.
"The good ones remained in town," said his father placidly. "But I think there are some old ones in the attic. Let's go take a look."
And indeed, by the light of the lamp that his father held aloft, among all sorts of rubbish in a case, Lucian found a chessboard. And again he had the feeling that all this had happened before. That open case with the nail sticking out of its side, those dust-powdered books, that wooden chessboard with a crack down the middle. A small box with a sliding lid also came to light. It contained puny chessmen. And the whole time he was looking for the chess set, and then carrying it down to the veranda,
Lucian tried to figure out whether it was by accident his father had mentioned chess, or whether he had noticed something, and the most obvious explanation did not occur to him, just as sometimes in solving a problem, its key turns out to be a move that seemed barred, impossible, excluded quite naturally from the range of possible moves.
And now, when the board had been placed on the illuminated table between the lamp and the raspberries, and its dust wiped off with a bit of newspaper, his father's face was no longer mocking, and Lucian, forgetting his fear, forgetting his secret, felt permeated all at once with proud excitement at the thought that he could, if he wanted, display his art. His father began to set out the pieces. One of the pawns was replaced by an absurd purple-colored affair in the shape of a tiny bottle. In place of one rook, there was a checker. The knights were headless, and the one horse's head that remained after the box had been emptied, leaving a small die and a red counter, turned out not to fit any of them. When everything had been set out, Lucian suddenly made up his mind and muttered,
"I already can play a little."
"Who taught you?" asked his father without lifting his head.
"I learned it at school," replied Lucian. "Some of the boys could play."
"Oh, fine," said his father, and added, quoting Pushkin's doomed duelist, "Let's start, if you are willing."
He has played chess since his youth, but only seldom and sloppily with haphazard opponents, on serene evenings aboard a Volga steamer in the foreign sanatorium where his brother was dying years ago. Here in the country, with the village doctor, an unsociable man who periodically ceased calling on them, and all these chance games, full of oversights and sterile meditations, were for him little more than a moment of relaxation, or simply a means of decently preserving silence in the company of a person with whom conversation kept petering out. Brief, uncomplicated games, remarkable neither for ambition nor inspiration, which he always began in the same way, paying little attention to his adversary's moves. Although he made no fuss about losing, he secretly considered himself to be not at all a bad player, and told himself that if ever he lost, it was through absent-mindedness, good nature, or a desire to enliven the game with daring sallies, and he considered that with a little application it was possible, without theoretic knowledge, to refute any gambit out of the textbook. His son's passion for chess had so astounded him, seemed so unexpected, and at the same time so fateful and inescapable, so strange and awesome was it to sit on this bright veranda amid the black summer night, across from this boy whose tensed forehead seemed to expand and swell as soon as he bent over the pieces. All this was so strange and awesome that Lucian Sr. was incapable of thinking of the game, and while he feigned concentration, his attention wandered from vague recollections of his illicit day in St. Petersburg, that left a residue of shame it was better not to investigate, to the casual, easy gestures with which his son moved this or that piece. The game had lasted but a few minutes when his son said,
"If you do this, it's mate, and if you do that, you lose your queen."
And he, confused, took his move back and began to think properly, inclining his head first to the left and then to the right, slowly stretching out his fingers toward the queen, and quickly snatching them away again, as if burned, while in the meantime his son, calmly and with uncharacteristic tidiness, put the taken pieces into their box. Finally, Lucian Sr. made his move, whereupon there started a devastation of his positions, and then he laughed unnaturally and knocked his king over in sign of surrender. In this way, he lost three games, and realized that should he play 10 more, the result would be just the same,
and yet he was unable to stop. At the very beginning of the fourth game, Lusion pushed back the piece moved by his father, and with a shake of his head said in a confident, unchildlike voice, "The worst reply! Shigorin suggests taking the pawn." And when, with incomprehensible, hopeless speed, he had lost this game as well, Lusion Sr. again laughed, and with trembling hand began to pour milk into a cut-glass tumbler, on the bottom of which lay a raspberry core, which now floated to the surface and circled, unwilling to be extracted. His son put away the board and the box on a wicker table in the corner, and having blurted a phlegmatic, "Good night," softly closed the door behind him.
"Oh, well, I should have expected something like this," said Lusion Sr., wiping the tips of his fingers with a handkerchief. "He's not just amusing himself with chess. He's performing a sacred rite."
A fat-bodied, fluffy moth with glowing eyes fell on the table after colliding with the lamp. A breeze stirred lightly through the garden. The clock in the drawing room started to chime daintily and struck 12.
"Nonsense," he said. "Stupid imagination. Many youngsters are excellent chess players. Nothing surprising in that. The whole affair's getting on my nerves, that's all. Bad of her. She shouldn't have encouraged him. Well, no matter."
He thought drearily that in a moment he would have to lie, to remonstrate, to soothe, and it was midnight already.
"I want to sleep," he said,
but remained sitting in the armchair. And early next morning, in the darkest and mossiest corner of the dense coppice behind the garden, little Lusion buried his father's precious box of chessmen, assuming this to be the simplest way of avoiding any kind of complications, for now there were other chessmen that he could use openly. His father, unable to suppress his interest in the matter, went off to see the gloomy country doctor, who was a far better chess player than he, and in the evening, after dinner, laughing and rubbing his hands, doing his best to ignore the fact that all this was wrong, but why wrong he could not say, he sat his son down with the doctor at the wicker table on the veranda, himself set out the pieces, apologizing for the purple thingam, sat down beside the players, and began avidly following the game. Twitching his bushy eyebrows and tormenting his fleshy nose with a large hairy fist, the doctor thought long over every move, and from time to time would lean back in his chair as if able to see better from a distance, and make big eyes, and then lurch heavily forward, his hands braced against his knees. He lost, and grunted so loudly that his wicker armchair creaked in response.
"But look, look!" exclaimed Lusion Sr. "You should go this way, and everything is saved. You even have the better position."
"Don't you see I'm in check?" growled the doctor in a bass voice,
and began to set out the pieces anew. And when Lusion Sr. went out into the dark garden to accompany the doctor as far as the footpath with its border of glowworms leading down to the bridge, he heard the words he had so thirsted to hear once. But now these words weighed heavy upon him. He would rather not have heard them at all. The doctor started coming every night, and since he was really a first-rate player, he derived enormous pleasure from these incessant defeats. He brought Lusion a chess handbook, advising him, however, not to get too carried away by it, not to tire himself and to read in the open air. He spoke about the grand masters he had had the occasion to see, about a recent tournament, and also about the past of chess, about a somewhat doubtful Raja, and about the great Philidor, who was also an accomplished musician. At times, grinning gloomily, he would bring what he termed a sugar plum, an ingenious problem cut out of some periodical. Lusion would pore over it a while,
find finally the solution, and with an extraordinary expression on his face and radiant bliss in his eyes, would exclaim, burring his R's,
"How glorious! How glorious!"
But the notion of composing problems himself did not entice him. He dimly felt that they would be a pointless waste of the militant, charging, bright force he sensed within him whenever the doctor, with strokes of his hairy finger, removed his king farther and farther, and finally nodded his head and sat there quite still, looking at the board, while Lucian Sr., who was always present, always craving a miracle, his son's defeat, and was both frightened and overjoyed when his son won, and suffered from this complicated mixture of feelings, would seize a knight or a rook, crying that everything was not lost, and would himself sometimes play to the end a hopelessly compromised game. And thus it began. Between this sequence of evenings on the veranda, in the day when Lucian's photograph appeared in a St. Petersburg magazine, it was as if nothing had been, neither the country autumn drizzling on the asters, nor the journey back to town, nor the return to school. The photograph appeared on an October day soon after his first unforgettable performance in a chess club, and everything else that took place between the return to town and the photograph, 2 months after all, was so blurry and so mixed up that later, in recalling this time, Lucian was unable to say exactly when, for instance, that social evening had taken place at school, where, in a corner, almost unnoticed by his schoolfellows, he had quietly beaten the geography teacher, a well-known amateur, or when, on his father's invitation, a gray-haired Jew came to dinner, a senile chess genius who had been victorious in all the cities of the world, but now lived in idleness and poverty, purblind with a sick heart, having lost forever his fire, his grip, his luck. But one thing Lucian remembered quite clearly, the fear he experienced in school, the fear they would learn of his gift and ridicule him. And consequently, guided by this infallible recollection, he judged that after the game played at the social evening, he must not have gone to school anymore. For remembering all the shudders of his childhood, he was unable to imagine the horrible sensation he would have experienced upon entering the classroom on the following morning and meeting those inquisitive, all-knowing eyes. He remembered, on the other hand, that after his picture appeared, he refused to go to school, and it was impossible to untangle in his memory the knot in which the social evening and the photograph were joined. It was impossible to say which came first and which second. It was his father who brought him the magazine, and the photograph was one taken the previous year, in the country. A tree in the garden, and he next to it, a pattern of foliage on his forehead, a sullen expression on his slightly inclined face, and those narrow white shorts that always used to come unbuttoned in front. Instead of the joy expected by his father, he expressed nothing. But he did feel a secret joy. Now this would put an end to school. They pleaded with him during the course of a week. His mother, of course, cried. His father threatened to take away his new chess set, enormous pieces on a Morocco board. And suddenly, everything was decided of itself. He ran away from home, in his autumn coat, since his winter one had been hidden after one unsuccessful attempt to run away, and not knowing where to go, a stinging snow was falling and settling on the cornices, and the wind would blow it off, endlessly reenacting this miniature blizzard. He wandered finally to his aunt's place, not having seen her since spring. He met her as she was leaving. She was wearing a black hat and holding flowers wrapped in paper, on her way to a funeral.
"Your old partner is dead," she said. "Come with me."
Angry at not being allowed to warm himself, angry at the snow falling, and at the sentimental tears shining behind his aunt's veil, he turned sharply and walked away. And after walking about for an hour, set off for home. He did not remember the actual return, and even more curiously, was never sure whether things had happened thus or differently. Perhaps his memory later added much that was taken from his delirium, for he was delirious for a whole week, and since he was extremely delicate and high-strung, the doctors presumed he would not pull through. It was not the first time he had been ill, and when later reconstructing the sensation of this particular illness, he involuntarily recalled others of which his childhood had been full. He remembered especially the time when he was quite small, playing all alone and wrapping himself up in the tiger rug to represent, rather forlornly, a king. It was nicest of all to represent a king, since the imaginary mantle protected him against the chills of fever. And he wanted to postpone for as long as possible that inevitable moment when they would feel his forehead, take his temperature, and then bundle him into bed. Actually, there had been nothing quite comparable to this October chest-permeated illness. The gray-haired Jew who used to be Chigorin, the corpse of his aunt's admirer muffled in flowers, the sly, gay countenance of his father bringing a magazine, and the geography teacher petrified with the suddenness of the mate, and the tobacco smoke-filled room at the chess club where he was closely surrounded by a crowd of university students, and the clean-shaven face of the musician holding for some reason the telephone receiver like a violin between shoulder and cheek. All this participated in his delirium and took on the semblance of a kind of monstrous game on a spectral, wobbly, and endlessly disintegrating board. Upon his recovery, a taller and thinner boy, he was taken abroad, at first to the Adriatic coast, where he lay on the garden terrace in the sun and played games in his head, which nobody could forbid him, and then to a German resort where his father took him for walks along footpaths fenced off with twisted beech railings. 16 years later, when he revisited this resort, he recognized the bearded earthenware dwarfs between the flower beds, and the garden paths of colored gravel before the hotel that had grown bigger and handsomer, and also the dark, damp wood on the hill, and the motley daubs of oil paint, each hue marking the direction of a given walk, with which a beech trunk or a rock would be equipped at an intersection, so that the stroller should not lose his way. The same paperweights, bearing emerald-blue views touched up with mother-of-pearl beneath convex glass, were on sale in the shops near the spring, and no doubt the same orchestra on the stand in the park was playing potpourri of opera. And the same maples were casting their lively shade over small tables where people drank coffee and ate wedge-shaped slices of apple tart with whipped cream.
"Look, do you see those windows?" he said,
pointing with his cane at the wing of the hotel.
"It was there we had that pretty little tournament. Some of the most respectable German players took part. I was a boy of 14. Third prize. Yes, third prize."
He replaced both hands on the crook of his thick cane with that sad, slightly old mannish gesture that was natural to him now, and bent his head as if listening to distant music.
"What? Put on my hat? The sun is scorching, you say? I'd say it is ineffective. Why should you fuss about it? We are sitting in the shade."
Nevertheless, he took the straw hat extended to him across the little table, drummed on the bottom where there was a blurred dark spot over the hatmaker's name, and donned it with a wry smile. Wry in the precise sense. His right cheek and the corner of his mouth went up slightly, exposing bad tobacco-stained teeth. He had no other smile. And one would never have said that he was only beginning his fourth decade. From the wings of his nose there descended two deep, flabby furrows. His shoulders were bent. In the whole of his body one remarked an unhealthy heaviness. And when he rose abruptly, with raised elbow defending himself from a wasp, one saw he was rather stout. Nothing in the little illusion had foreshadowed this lazy, unhealthy fleshiness.
"But why does it pester me?"
he cried in a thin, querulous voice, continuing to lift his elbow and endeavoring with his other hand to get out his handkerchief. The wasp, having described one last circle, flew away, and he followed it with his eyes for a long time, mechanically shaking out his handkerchief. Then he set his metal chair more firmly on the gravel, picked up his fallen cane, and sat down again, breathing heavily.
"Why are you laughing? Wasps are extremely unpleasant insects."
Frowning, he looked down at the table. Beside his cigarette case lay a handbag, semicircular, made of black silk. He reached out for it absently and began to click the lock.
"Shuts badly," he said without looking up. "One fine day, you'll spill everything out."
He sighed, laid the handbag aside, and added in the same tone of voice,
"Yes, the most respectable German players, and one Austrian. My late papa was unlucky. He hoped there would be no real interest in chess here, and we landed right in a tournament."
Things had been rebuilt and jumbled. The wing of the house now looked different. They had lived over there on the second floor. It had been decided to stay until the end of the year and then return to Russia, and the ghost of school, which his father dared not mention, again loomed into view. His mother went back much earlier, at the beginning of summer. She said she was insanely homesick for the Russian countryside, and that protracted insanely with such a plaintive, aching middle syllable was practically the sole intonation of hers that Luzhin retained in his memory. She left reluctantly, however, not really knowing whether to go or stay. It was already some time since she had begun to experience a strange feeling of estrangement from her son, as if he had drifted away somewhere, and the one she loved was not this grown-up boy, not the chess prodigy that the newspapers were writing about, but that little warm, insupportable child who at the slightest provocation would throw himself flat on the floor, screaming and drumming his feet. And everything was so sad and so unnecessary. That sparse, un-Russian lilac in the station garden, those tulip-shaped lamps in the sleeping car of the Nord Express, and those sinking sensations in the chest, a feeling of suffocation, perhaps angina pectoris, and perhaps, as her husband said, simply nerves. She went away and did not write. His father grew gayer and moved to a smaller room, and then one July day, when little Luzhin was on his way home from another hotel, in which lived one of those morose elderly men who were his playmates, accidentally, in the bright low sun, he caught sight of his father by the wooden railings of a hillside path. His father was with a lady, and since that lady was certainly his young red-haired aunt from St. Petersburg, he was very surprised and somehow ashamed, and he did not say anything to his father. Early one morning, a few days after this, he heard his father swiftly approach his room along the corridor, apparently laughing loudly. The door was burst open, and his father entered holding out a slip of paper, as if thrusting it away. Tears rolled down his cheeks and along his nose, as if he had splashed his face with water, and he kept repeating with sobs and gasps,
"What's this? What's this? It's a mistake! They've got it wrong!"
And continued to thrust away the telegram.